enjoyed and got a lot out of the weeks we spent on Shir HaShirim, on Song of Songs. And now I'm looking forward to the time we're going to have for Mishle. It could be end up being 11 weeks. We'll see. We still need to get to Koheles, to Ecclesiastes at the end of the year, and that's going to have to be its own definitely minimum 11 weeks. So I don't know. We'll figure it out. But I also, I learned some things. I picked some things up from the way things went with Shir HaShirim that'll influence the way that we approach Mishle. In particular, I felt like with Shir HaShirim, we spent a lot of time in the beginning on sort of things that are about the book, like who wrote it and things like that, and not enough time initially on the actual content. And I think it made it harder to grasp the other outside information. So I'm going to try to sort of change the order a little bit for this. The problem is that there is external information that we need in order to understand the book. It all goes together. So we'll see. But I want to thank again Shai Shemayim as well as Mikorot for partnering on this class, and Aya in our office for handling registration. And as always, I am recording audio, and next week's class will hopefully, next week's email will have a link for the audio recordings from today. And then once we have, I think, two on the YU Torah website, it will create a collection, and then it'll be one link to get all the Mishle recordings. I muted everybody by default because I was getting some background noise. Hopefully you aren't going to get too much background noise from the school that I'm based in, but you never know. Okay, so welcome to the book of Mishle, Proverbs. Worth noting, it also goes by some other names, related names. If you look in the first source on your source sheet, I noted there Proverbs equals Mishle, and that's the term that the Talmud uses in Bava Basra. It also, though, gets called Mishalot in the Medrash on Shir HaShirim when they're talking about the books that Shlomo HaMelech, that King Solomon, wrote. So it gets called Mishalot. And then there's a Gemara in Gittin where it's called Memshalot. So all of these are the same thing. Don't get hung up on that. We have too many other things to get hung up on. Don't get hung up on that one. We're going to have many big questions to ask about this book. One of the big questions that come up, let me ask you before I start on the big question, how many of you have read some part of Mishle besides Eishes Chayil at the end? That doesn't count. But in terms of the book itself, okay, so I see some hands. Some people have read some parts of Mishle before. Not everybody. So you know what? Take a look in your Mishle for a second. Just open up the book itself. Whether you have a full Tanakh, whether you have just the book of Mishle itself, I'm going to open up at random, okay? Not picking anything in particular, but I want to get past the first bit. Okay, this is a good one. Take a look at chapter 17, sentence 1. Okay? Chapter 17, sentence 1. So there it says, I'm just going to do a quick translation into English, but you can see the original in your Mishle. Better to have dry bread and peace, tranquility, as opposed to a house that is full of sacrifices or slaughterings of battle, meaning that there's a lot of food there, but there's strife, right? That's that's one of the lessons, one of the many, many lessons found in the book of Mishle. Another one in the very next sentence, Ebed Maskil, a slave who has insight, Yimshol Bebein Mevish, he will rule over a son who is Mevish. Mevish we could take as somebody who does things that are bad. It's a little bit of a loose translation, but it'll do for now. And among brothers, he will get a share. This Eved, this slave, will get a share. Meaning, insight matters a lot more than your standing, than your social standing. You take a look at those two lessons, which again, I pulled at random and hadn't intended to speak about today. The lesson of the value of tranquility over wealth. the lesson of the value of insight over social standing. If you, you know, rolled back your mind 5 minutes to before we started on Mishlei, would you not have known those things? Would those have been novel to you? If someone asked you, is it better to have a lot of food around, or is it better to have peace and calm in your home? How many of you would have voted for better to have a lot of food around? Now, maybe the hungrier you are, the more apt you are to vote for the food. I hear that. It's lunchtime. But as a general principle, that's not novel. When I think about King Solomon as the wisest of all, if that's all he has to tell me, frankly, I'm not so impressed. Or maybe I'm just very impressed with myself, because I knew that. The ditto in the insight over social standing and so on as you go through the book. A lot of it seems like I could have told you that. So take a look at source number 2 on your sheet. This is from an article by Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein on the study of Tanakh. It's part of a volume from something called the Orthodox Forum. His article is called Fear of God, the Beginning of Wisdom and the End of Tanakh Study. And first I brought you the text and then the footnote on the text. The footnote's the part that we really want to get to, but you have to start with the text itself. He says, he's dealing with the issue of commentary, medrash and commentary on biblical text that is sometimes simplistic. And he says, let us now return to Tanakh and utilize these metaphors and analogies as a guide to assist us in determining our approach to Tanakh. The first conclusion to be drawn is that there must be age differentiation. When you learn Tanakh, a lot depends on how old the student is. The child should receive a version of the Torah that appeals to his imagination and understanding, even at the expense of depth and sophistication. It will therefore be a more vivid and less introspective approach that may often be two-dimensional and schematic, with the emphasis upon action rather than reflection. Right? You follow what he's saying? In true Lichtensteinian style, he has a lot of syllables. But what he's saying, I think we can get. He says, thus Rashi, who is a quintessential, quote, amplifier, will consistently portray the heroes in a more positive light than the psukim, the verses themselves, thereby making the good guys better, while the villains are usually cast in a more negative light that will always make the bad guys seem worse. It is a didactic world of black and white that does its best to eliminate gray from its universe and therefore most appropriate for the child's needs. So his point is that when children study Tanakh, they come at it from, the way we teach them, I should say, we come at it from an approach that simplifies in order to give them lessons that are more black and white until they're old enough to comprehend gray. That's the point in his text. And then you get his footnote. And he says, an enlightening example from Tanakh itself is the interplay between Mishlei and Iyov. Now, some of you spent 2 years studying Iyov with me, so you already know what I think about the book of Iyov. But just on a very basic level, Iyov is a case in which you have a human being who is suffering, who is angry that God will not communicate with him, right? And he's suffering without having done anything wrong, right? That's what the book tells us. He is suffering without having sinned. So he says, both books address the issue of divine justice, but in markedly different perspectives. Mishlei presents a conventional, almost facile morality that portrays a world in which the righteous are always rewarded and the wicked never prosper. You do good things, you practice what you learn from wisdom, and everything's going to be wonderful. The outlook of the companions that Sefer Iyov so unflinchingly attacks is the very world that Mishlei champions, right? The visitors to Iyov who say to him, if you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. If you're good, God is going to help you. That's the view of Mishlei. The juxtaposition of the two, because they appear side by side in Tanakh, is almost an act of self-reflection on the part of Tanakh, with Iyov serving to call into question the conclusions of its companion Sefer. one of the more plausible suggestions to explain the discrepancy. Why is it that Mishlei presents such a simple world, and Iyov presents a world in which justice is not served, is that Mishlei is addressed to the young child, while Iyov reflects the world of the adult. The voice of the narrator in Mishlei is the didactic parental voice, while Iyov presents the raging debate of the embittered adult conversing with his peers. Each message is age-appropriate for the needs of its participants. You follow? His argument is that Mishlei is meant to as teaching children. This is what I tell children. That's one perspective. And we're going to see others who take that view. He's not the only one. But now I want to show you source number three. This is a Gemara in Brachos. We actually saw it, a related piece of it when we started Shir HaShirim. The Gemara here is talking about dreams and interpreting dreams. And specifically here, what happens if in a dream you envision a book from Tanakh? And it tells us, Shlosha Ksuvim Gedolim Heim. There are three large writings, right? From the section of Tanakh called Ketuvim, there are three large books. Haroa Sefer Tehillim. If you see the book of Tehillim of Psalms, Yitzapa Lachasidus. So that's a sign to you that piety is coming to you. If you have a dream and you see Tehillim in your dream, don't get scared. Don't think it means somebody's sick and oh no. No, no, no. That's not what Tehillim is. Tehillim is a sign of piety. Mishlei, if you see Proverbs in your dream, Yitzap el Chochma, that means wisdom is coming, because the book of Proverbs is a book of wisdom. And Yob, if somebody sees Job, Yidag min apuranus, they should worry about suffering coming, because that's not a good sign if you see Job in a dream. Unless you fell asleep while you were, you know, learning it. That's a different story. But the point for us is that here we're told that Mishlei represents, Proverbs represents wisdom. So which is it? Is it for kids? Is it a children's book? Or is it a book of wisdom? That's one question that we're going to want to talk about. I'm not answering it now. I'm not asking for discussion of it now, because it's a question that we really need to explore in a serious way once we know more about the book. But that's one question. Another question that comes up, is this a Jewish book? Now, those who have learned any of Mishlei have seen God show up in the book. Hashem is there throughout the book. So you'd say, well, it seems like it's a religious book for sure, and we use the Jewish names for Hashem. There are ideals in there that seem to be Jewish ideals. Take a look, though, at source number four from Professor Avigdor Hurwitz. He's not the only one to make this point. This is made by a lot of people. You can break up the book of Mishlei into multiple parts. And we're going to talk about how to do that. You can already see on your source sheet, if you were to flip to the second side, you'll see I bring you a number of different ways to break it up. So the third part of the book, as he reads it, is the part that begins in chapter 22, with the words of sages, Divrei Chachamim. It's very, it's a relatively short section. From the middle of chapter 22 to the end of chapter 24. So he says, that section, Amur lehiyot kal letearuch chiburo ulezihui rik'o. It's really easy for us to date that, to figure out when it was written. Hurwitz is not coming at it from an observant Jewish perspective. He's not looking at it in terms of canonization by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. He says it's really easy for us to date the writing of this book, of this section, I should say, and to identify the setting in which these thoughts in it were drafted. Why? Ki hu misbaseis b'tzuraso ha-kolelas u'mechelek mitochano al hora'ot. I'm going to pronounce it as amenemope, which is not the word that he's using in Hebrew. Hamid Egyptian. He says, this section in Mishlei is based in its overall structure and in part of its content on an Egyptian piece of wisdom literature, which was composed, he says, in the era of Ramses before Shlomo's time. So what we're going to see is an argument that parts of Mishlei come from a different culture. And it's not only going to be about this Egyptian Amenemope fellow, because you're going to see, when you get, let's say, to chapter 30, there is a scribe mentioned there whose name is Agur ben Yakeh. Not a name that we think of as a Jewish name. And we're going to have to discuss. So who is this Agur fellow? We'll see other names too. So could it be that parts of this book come from another culture? And does that matter? Let's say the answer is yes. Who cares? That's something we're going to have to explore. Ricky asks, what does a Jewish book? I assume you're asking, what is a Jewish book? So some of you were there at Tanakh in a Day when I talked about the question of whether Eov was Jewish or not Jewish. And we talked about there the question of what makes a book Jewish, so to speak. So hold the thought, though, until we get back into this question of whether this book has elements that are brought in that are not from Jewish sages. We're not going to come back to that question this week. That'll probably be next week. But what I want to do is start us off with an overview of the Book of Mishlei, the structure, the contents, the message. Then I want to spend a little time on some tangential but important issues. The use of Mishlei in prayer, communal public readings of Mishlei, the role of Mishlei in Medrash, in Musar, in Kabbalah, like things like that. And then I want to come back to the book and learn particular parts of the book. That's where I want to go with this. Clear? So we were going to begin. Well, let me pause there. Questions and comments. I haven't said anything of substance yet. I raised a couple of questions, but any issues? Yes, Ricky.
In the chronology of written books in the Tanakh, at what point is this book written, and at what point is this book known? Is it before some books or after some books? Where does it fit in the...
That's a really good question, which we will get to, possibly a little bit this week, more of it next week. The problem is that the book itself generates confusion on that front. I mean, I'll just show you the confusion. Jump to chapter 25, sentence 1. Okay, you see that? This is the beginning of a section, at least by most ways of breaking up the book. And it tells us these, what's coming, are also Mishlei Shlomo, the Proverbs of Solomon, Asher he'etiku anshei Chizkiyah melech Yehuda, that were he'etiku. I'm going to translate he'etiku as copied for now, like we use it in modern Hebrew. But we'll see there are other ways to translate this. But that were copied by the men of Chizkiyah, king of Yehuda. Well, those are two different periods. Shlomo, Solomon, right, would mean that it is before Yeshaya, before Yirmiyahu, before, you know, Yechezkel, before a lot of the prophecies, a lot of Treyasar, is going to be after this book if it's dated from Shlomo. On the other hand, Chizkiyahu we know, right? Chizkiyahu is towards the end of the time of Yeshaya, right? And it's his men who are recording this. You're talking about something that has to happen, I don't know, 100 years, maybe more, after Shlomo? I forget how long it is. I mean, we know certain kings, we can do a little math. More than 100 years after Shlomo.
So how was it recorded in the first place?
So we're going to talk about authorship and everything. But I just try to answer your basic question of when is it, by telling you it's confusing, right? We have two answers right now in one verse. So we're going to have to see. We're going to have to see. Other questions or comments before we proceed? Yes, Susan.
We mentioned Eov. And when we learned Eov, there were a lot of commentaries that we read about who wrote it, all of that, and that it was a Jewish book. Well, since it's here being compared to Eov and the opposite of Eov, is that also like matter about the writer?
Not so much. It's an interesting question, but not so much. We have more clarity for Mishlei than we do for Eov. Eov, as you said, is incredibly fraught, the question of authorship of Eov. Mishlei doesn't resemble Eov in a lot of ways. I mean, it's the opposite we saw in terms of message. But also, Mishlei, for the most part, the language is a lot easier than the Eov language. The language that's so frustrating in Eov is not as frustrating in Mishlei. And you'll see when we get to discuss the authorship, it's more straightforward than it is in Eov. Yeah, Janine.
Just in regards to Moshe Lichtenstein's thoughts, it can sound simplistic. It's kind of pop psychology today, sounds, and coaching and all that sounds simplistic. But that doesn't mean we don't have to internalize certain things even if we know them. I think that's not necessarily childish. Maybe we need the reminder, because it's written as part of Tanakh. That means we have to really try to carry it out, not just know intellectually.
Right. Right. So Janine is saying it could very well be important as a reinforcer and refresher for adults. That's what you're saying?
I don't see it as childish. I think it's something that everybody needs.
We're going to come back to that issue. There are at this moment, I have in my notes, I think, 6 different approaches to this question of who the target audience is. I'm hoping to narrow it down a bit by the time we get to it next week, but we'll see. Okay. So, broad outline, the units of Sefer Mishlei. I find it really useful to break up a book into units. I do it with chapters also, like those of you who are in my Thursday afternoon Shmuel, shiur. So when I approach a new perek, a new chapter, I want to know what the units are within it. Units help us learn. We can grasp a message that's being given across a series of psukim, of verses. We can see a thought develop. It's always a good idea to identify the units. Interestingly, writers also, in discussing Mishlei, see significance in the number of units. So Avigdor Hurwitz, who I mentioned in source number 4, identifies 7 units that make up the book. And he says, 7 is a very important number. We find 7 in important ways throughout Tanakh. Rabbi Chaim Angel, in a shir that's available on YU Torah, says it would be really interesting if there would be 5 books in Mishlei, which is one way to break it up, because we have 2 other books of Tanakh that have 5 parts, right? What are they? What, Hana? You're muted.
Chamishah
Mishlei Tovot,
of course.
Yeah, and? Leah put it in the chat. Tehillim. Right? We have the 5 books of the Chumash, and then we have 5 books of Tehillim. So the way Rabbi Angel frames it is Chumash is God's word to human beings. Tehillim is human beings talking to God. And then Mishlei is human beings talking to human beings. I thought that was a very interesting way to look at that. But in as much as there are different ways to try to, to read the different units that are in the book, it's hard to actually pin it down and say, okay, here's the way it works. It's really hard to do it by topic, right? That would be my choice. If I could choose how to break up Mishlei, I would say, well, there should be a unit here on this topic, and then a unit on this topic, and you forget it. It doesn't happen that way. That's just not, it hops between similar and related topics. For much of the book, there is a change of topic with every 1 to 3 sentences. And again, hopping around. If you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Menachem Meiri, in the, I think it was 13th century into the 14th, he introduces chapter 10, and he's commenting about verses that appear in chapter 23. He actually gives you a breakdown. Take a look at the verses, because otherwise it isn't going to make any sense. Look at chapter 23, sentence 15. Okay? Actually, you know what? I'm not sure why I would require. You don't need to read it in order to get it. It's okay. You don't need to have read it in order to get what he's saying. I'm not sure why I made that point on the sheet. But take a look at what he says in number 5. He says, Mehena, from the end of chapter 9, the first 9 chapters of the book are a unit. They're a single thing. But then he says, from here, from the beginning of chapter 10, Nishlam inyan achelak harishon, the whole first section is done. Yavo achrav achelak hasheni be'ezras Hashem, and afterwards comes the second segment with God's help. Ve'inenu holeich al seder devarim nimshachim v'parshios karishon, and it doesn't follow the order of things flowing through sections the way the first part of the book does. The first 9 chapters of the book are easy. Aval kulo psukim meforadim. When you get to chapter 10, it's all individual verses. Ein bahem hitkashrut v'harkava ze'im zeh. They don't have a connection one to the next. Rak harkavat shcheinut. Only the connection of being a neighbor. This one is before this one, which is before that one. V'chol pasuk u'pasuk shebahem inyan b'fnei atzmo. Each verse is its own topic. Levad me'at she'yizkashrut k'tzas p'sukim ze'im zeh. Aside from a minority for which some verses tie one to the next. And he says, "Kol zos haparsha ad bechokma yivne bayis chavdal gemo hakol inyan echad mesaper ban hagas ha'avu bedrachaso lebein." And then he gives you an example, and this is where he makes the comment in chapter 23. He says, "You do get the advice of a father to a son there in chapter 23, running until the beginning of chapter 24." So he says, "Here you see an example of a unit." I saw the question in the chat. Ricky asked who assigned the chapter numbers. It's the same as we've said elsewhere in Tanakh, which is that came from the church. We did not assign the chapter numbers. Sometimes their chapter numbers work, and sometimes their chapter numbers absolutely do not. That's the way it goes, right? You may recall, because you're in the Shmuel Shir on Thursday afternoon, that chapter 27 in Shmuel Aleph really should end after the second verse of chapter 28. 28, 1 and 2 really belong in chapter 27. Why did they choose to divide it up that way? You got me. I don't know. But the Meiri believes very much in trying to find links and context. That's his approach to Tanakh overall, is he loves context. And that's really the way that he interprets biblical text. But it's very hard in Mishlei. I'm going to try to present a topical outline in a bit, and you'll see how challenging it is. But before we go there, the most basic approach is to approach Mishlei based on the headings that are given in it. And if you take a look at source number 6, I gave you there 3 verses to look at, and you'll see instantly what I mean when you look at those verses. Chapter 1, sentence 1. Right, the beginning of our book. Flipping pages in mind. Mishlei Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael. That's a fine heading. Right, that's a heading to make you proud. You wanted to draft a heading? The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. That's a proper heading. Then you jump to chapter 10, sentence 1. This is after 9 chapters that, again, are all one unit. Just thematically, they're all one unit. So chapter 10, sentence 1. Mishlei Shlomo, the Proverbs of Solomon. And then he goes into a proverb. A wise son will gladden his father. A foolish son is the mourning for his mother, right? Okay. That's also Mishlei Shlomo. That's an introduction. And then chapter 25, sentence 1, which I've already shown you. Right? Gam Elam Mishlei Shlomo. These are also the Proverbs of Shlomo that were recorded by the men of Chizkiah, king of Yehuda. So right here I have 3 headings. And I could look at it and say, oh, okay, then there are 3 books. And in fact, if you look at source number 7 on your sheet, I brought you from Shir HaShirim Rabbah, the Medrash on Shir HaShirim, Gimel Mishalot Amar. Shlomo spoke 3 Mishalot. 3 books of Mishlei, right? I told you, you call the book Mishalot. Mishlei Shlomo, the one in the first chapter, when it said Mishlei Shlomo. then chapter 10, sentence 1, and then chapter 25, sentence 1. This passage in the Medrash says there are three books in Mishle. However, if I'm going to do that, then maybe there are five parts. And that's in fact what Meiri believes. If you take a look at source number 8, he points you to chapter 30, sentence 1, which has its own heading. I referred you to this heading, but now you can take a look at it. Chapter 30, sentence 1. Divrei Agur ben Yakeh. The words of Agur, son of Yakeh. Hamasa ne'uma geber le'itiel ve'uchal. Who are Itiel and Uchal? We'll have to talk about. But this seems to be another heading, right? No? Right? These are the words of Agur ben Yakeh. Who is Agur ben Yakeh? We have to find out. And then go to chapter 31, sentence 1. Divrei Limuel Melech, the words of King Limuel, and then the word Masa, which could be a name of a country. He is the king of Masa, or they're a Masa, which is like a harsh message of rebuke. Asher Yisrato Imo, Yisratu Imo, I should say, that his mother offered as rebuke. We're going to have to talk about that one eventually. We're not getting there right now. My point is simply to say, and this is what the Meiri says, we could have five headings. If we go based on just lines that seem to be describing some sort of authorship, there are five units in the book, and maybe that's the way that we should look at it. Clear? That's the question here. Interesting, to note, it's really something I should hold till later. I should hold it till later. Ignore source number 9. It's just going to confuse things right now. Just ignore source number 9. I'm going to come back to it. Professor Yehuda Kiel, in the Dat Mikra edition of Mishle, as well as Professor Hurwitz, think that there are more headings in the book. You could divide the book up still further. So that, for example, if we take a look at source number 10, you'll see the references. Chapter 22, sentence 17. Says, Hat oznecha ushma divrei chachamim. Bend your ear, incline your ear, and listen to the words of sages. Maybe that's also the beginning of a section. Chapter 24, sentence 23. Gam eila lachachamim. These are also words of the sages. And then chapter 30, sentence 15, has a very odd beginning where it says, La aluka, for aluka. And the question is aluka a name? Or is aluka a word? What word would it be? We're going to have to come back to aluka. I'm not doing that right now. But the point is, one approach to the book is to look for titles of sections and say, based on that, we can identify units, and based on that, we could perhaps learn the book. That's one approach. A second approach is to work with the style of the book. And what I mean by style, take a look at source number 11 and you'll see right away. Chapters 1 to 9, this is a breakdown that offered by Avigdor Hurwitz. Chapters 1 to 9, like I said, are really one unit. You can track it very easily, beginning to end. Then, the next 11 and a half chapters or so are brief pieces, sections of 1 to 3 sentences that are topic. Hurwitz quotes somebody who views it as being like a legal code in the ancient world. Meiri tries so hard to find connections between these little units. Then you get a segment of cause and command. The following thing is bad, therefore do this. Do this because otherwise such and such that's bad is going to happen. There might be 30 segments in there. I'll explain eventually why I say 30 with a question mark. That we'll come back to next week. That's followed by a section which has statements about speech and laziness. So there is a sort of general theme. It's very short, the end of chapter 24. Then you have a section, chapters 25 to 29, with pieces that were like in the second part of the book, but they're longer pieces. Chapter 30 has proverbs that are based around numbers, threes and fours and that kind of thing. And then chapter 31 is the famous Eshet Chayil, often mistranslated as woman of valor. So you could try to do it based on that. So there's block, individual sentences. Block, individual sentence, you know, you could try to break it up like that. And if that helps you, gesundheit, that's wonderful. For me, the only thing that works is topics. So number 12, I tried to create an outline based on topics to the extent that I could. So the opening seven verses of the book are an introduction, and we're going to go through that very closely. Then you get the rest of chapter 1, as well as all of chapter 2, a statement of listen to Mussar, listen to ethical instruction, gain wisdom early, and that way you will avoid getting trapped into sin. Wisdom brings you to God and saves you from danger. In general, that opening section, the first 9 chapters, is basically about why you should acquire wisdom. That's what you'll see. So chapters 3 and 4 give you positive activity. This is what you should be looking to do. Choose the paths of Torah, generosity, truth, faith, listen to God. God protects and handles everything. Torah improves your life. Things that you should do. Chapters 5 to 7, things you should not do. Stay away from things that are bad. Avoid evil traits. Torah will protect you from the bad influences. That's chapters 5 to 7. If you're familiar with Mishlei and the Isha Zara, the warnings about the foreign woman, that's chapters 5 to 7. If you're not familiar with that, don't worry. By the time we finish this series, you will be. Chapter 8, the greatness and glory of Torah. Chapter 9, wisdom builds wisdom. The more wisdom you got, the more wisdom you'll get. Then a whole bunch of wise ways are in chapter 10. Then we have contrasts of the ways of righteousness and the ways of evil, contrasts of the behavior and the impact of the wicked and the righteous, the sage and the fool. Then chapter 16 and 17, one-line proverbs, and I just can't unify it, and I can't find a theme. It's just one-line proverbs. Deal with it. Then more about the wicked versus the righteous, the sage versus the fool, and then coming back to one-line proverbs, and then you get the number-oriented proverbs, and then you have Eshet Chayil at the end. I don't know if this is at all helpful. I'm trying. You remember when we did Shir HaShirim that, you know, I tried also to give you an outline in the beginning, but it was only for me once we had gone through the book with different explanations that I started to really have a good picture. So maybe once we've also done content, that will help this coalesce a little bit for people. Pausing here. Questions and comments.
I like your list of topics.
Thank you. Yeah, I just don't find that the structure helps me unless I know like what they're talking about. I find that to be true.
I just think, Rabbi, give us a guideline. It doesn't have to be always completely succinct, but give us a guide of what's going on and where to go. Especially okay. If you're not as experienced as some people in the audience.
Right. Or me, for that matter. I'm not experienced either.
No, me.
All of us. Okay. So, yeah, Dahlia.
I think that what you're saying about wisdom, we know. We're all adults in this class. We've lived a life. But some of this what we call common sense, is not natural for school children.
Right. You might want to try using the chat. I feel terrible for your throat. Yes, Susan.
Also, this was written a heck of a long time ago.
Yes.
And what we take for granted as knowledge, because we've all gone to school and a lot of things, may not have been taken for granted in this time period, because many couldn't read. Many didn't have access to a lot of this. So I think you have to take the time period and what the common person knew as well into consideration.
So I hear what you're saying in terms of facts, but in terms of ideas like you'll enjoy life more, you'll live a better life in the event that you stop running after wealth and instead look at relationships, right? Like, that's universal, and it doesn't require literacy to understand it.
No, but if you're working as a serf, right, all day long, you don't have time to think of these kind of things. It's not, you just get to bed, and you don't have time to actually say, hey, if I didn't worry about wealth, well, if I don't have money to feed my kids, that's all I'm going to worry about. But when you put it in context or in these sayings, it says, hey, wait a minute, maybe I have to look at things differently.
So you're raising a really interesting question that I'm still trying to figure out how to fit into the introduction to the book, which is, there's a term that Hurwitz likes to use, the Beit HaYotzer, the craftsman's house, so to speak. What is the frame of reference for the writer of Mishle and for the audience of Mishle? He goes through the Proverbs and he notes, for example, that a lot of them talk about how you relate to royalty, how you relate to a king. But others are about farming. And others are about business, extending loans, borrowing money. It's not just targeted. I mean, serf is an anachronism. You wouldn't have had serfs in the time of Shlomo. But I get what you're saying. You know, whether it's somebody who works for a farmer or whether somebody who works, you know, for a landowner, whatever. So, yeah, the point is well taken. You need to know what exactly is their frame of reference. The problem is that there are a lot of frames of reference in this book. It's not clear.
A bunch of new topics that were here.
Yeah.
Like about the business, that's all topics too.
Yeah. No, that's true. I'm just saying that in terms of knowing who the target audience is in their day, it seems to be a range, and a range of strata of society.
No, and I'm just saying there's also more topics.
Yeah.
That you could divide it a different way, the way you just mentioned it to us. A farming business.
Yeah, they're in here. They're in Mishle, I'm saying.
Yeah, I'd say, but the range you gave us didn't mention those yet. Those are different topics.
Oh, I see. No, because they're, when I say like a range of wise ways, so those are some of the wise ways.
Okay.
Yeah. They're all represented here. It's just this is an overview rather than granular.
I understand about the range because it bothers me.
Okay. So what I want to do now is talk about the name of the book and what the word mashal really means. I keep translating it as proverb, but you know that that's not the way most people translate the word mashal. When you hear somebody use the word mashal, often they translate it as?
Yep.
Sorry?
Example
or parable.
Yeah.
Right? Parable is always the one. I grew up hearing the word parable as the translation of mashal, like knee-jerk. Mashal is parable. Never mind that I didn't know what a parable was. But a parable, what's a parable? It's a mashal. So what exactly is a mashal in the book of Mishle? So a parable, which is the popular use of the word, is a story that conveys a lesson or an idea. And that certainly shows up in Mishle. I gave you two references for examples in source number 13. Take a look at chapter 6 as an example. Chapter 6, sentence 27. I'm going to translate it loosely rather than read the Hebrew and translate, because we're, believe it or not, already 45 minutes in. Can a man stoke coals in his lap or in his coat and his clothing won't get burned? If somebody walks on coals, will his feet not get singed? So too, a man who gets involved with somebody else's wife, anybody who touches her, will not escape cleanly. So that's a very clear mashal nimshal, right? The mashal, the parable is, you got some guy who's playing with fire and he gets burned. And the lesson is, you get involved with somebody else's spouse, you're going to get burned. You follow? That's a parable in the classic sense. A longer parable is found in the next chapter, chapter 7. Starting with sentence 7. We're not going to go through the whole thing. You can already see it, though. He says, I saw among the fools, I understood, perhaps, among the children, a youth who had no heart, meaning who had no understanding. And he walked in the market by her corner, and he stepped past her house in the evening, at night, in the dark, and the woman came out to greet him, and you can see what goes on from there. And this is a parable that's meant to speak of people who get trapped into doing things that they should not do. They get lured into it. The parable part is the youth who's walking very innocently in a dangerous or a bad part of town. So that's an example of the classic mashal, the classic parable, and in that case it's about being lured into something that's religiously destructive. But really the term mashal in Tanakh is much broader. And that's seen in Mishle. Sometimes, if you take a look at source number 14, sometimes a mashal is an image used for the sake of comparison, to make a point more intensely. So look at the references I gave you in number 14. Chapter 17, sentence 12. Okay, you see that? I don't know how much time to allow people to shuffle pages. Vanessa's looking at me like, more time. Chapter 17, sentence 12. Better to encounter a bear that has lost its young than a fool in his foolishness. You see that? Chapter 17, sentence 12. Better to meet a bear than a fool. Okay? The point here is to use the image in order to make the point more intense. If you just say to somebody, fools are dangerous, don't get involved with them, yeah, fine, I've said as soon as you finish the sentence. But if you say to me, you know, better to encounter a mother bear that lost its young than to get involved with a fool, that's an image. That captures the imagination. Now I understand what you're saying, and now I'm going to remember it. Sometimes, a mashal takes an image to teach a non-traditional educational statement. Something that'll get you out of the box and you're going to be surprised. Take a look at chapter 6, sentence 6, as an example of this. You may have seen this at some point. This is popular. It tells the lazy person, go to the ant, see the ways of the ant, and become wise. And it goes on to praise the ways of the ant. Right? So what's the value of using the ant as an example? You could have just given me the ways that you think are to be emulated. The fact that it doesn't have anybody in charge, and yet it prepares all of its, all of its food in the summertime, and it has everything ready. Like, you didn't need the ant. But the point of saying, look at the ant, is to give the reader a jolt, and to say, hey, pay attention, this is interesting. You follow? Sometimes, there's no image at all in the mashal. It's just a lesson presented in poetic form. Take a look at chapter 10, sentence 9, and you'll see one type. Chapter 10, sentence 9. This is the type where you have two parts, and the second reinforces the first. Okay? So, somebody who walks in innocence will walk securely. On the other hand, somebody who is corrupt in his ways, he will be found out. One who is innocent, this. One who is not innocent, that. Right? There's no image here. It's just a second and a first. And the second, I guess, reinforces the first. With this, it does, you know, it will reinforce the first. On the other hand, if you look at the next sentence, you see the very next sentence? Koreitz ayin yitein atzaves. Somebody who winks, yitein atzaves, will cause pain. Somebody who winks as a way to hint something to somebody, to trick someone, will cause pain. And the fool, actually, I don't know, sfasayim yilavet. I don't remember what that means.
My translation.
Yeah.
My translation for seven,
for ten.
It says, the mansion of the righteous is a blessing.
No, you're on sentence seven. I'm on sentence ten.
Okay, I'm sorry. My ten says, he who winks his eye begets heartbreak.
Yeah.
And the foolish of lips will become bewildered.
Okay, I hear that. That's not like what I'm seeing in the Targum, but okay, I'll take bewildered.
It's Rabbi Sachs' one.
Okay. The message that it's trying to get across is contrasting these two behaviors. A better example would probably be the next example that I gave there in sentence 15, same chapter. You see that? The wealth of the wealthy is the source of his strength, whereas mechitat dalim reisham, the dal, the person who is a pauper, is cut off by his poverty. It's not talking about wealth and poverty here, as the commentators explain it. It's talking about who has wisdom and who doesn't have wisdom, and having wisdom is a source of strength, whereas foolishness is a source of downfall. It's giving you a contrast. My point in bringing this wasn't actually to study these verses. My point in bringing it was just to show you sometimes the second half of the sentence reinforces the first half, and sometimes they're a contrast. The bottom line out of this, and what I wanted to get to, is to say that mashal really just means educational lesson with layers of meaning. That's the way we use the term mashal in Mishlei. And the Me'iri, in source number 15, gives us four different types of mishalim that are here in the book. I'm looking at the passage of time, and I'm just going to read out my English translation in number 15. He says, the term mashal includes many types. Sometimes it refers to a case where the only meaning is in the lesson, but the mashal resembles the lesson as a positive or as a negative, like saying of the Assyrian king as a positive, a cedar in Lebanon, fine branches, a shaded forest of great height, that's a passage in Yechezkel. And so the opposite, the deficiency of the subject, all the trees said to the thorn, you reign over us. So sometimes, he says, a mashal has no inherent meaning, but it's hinting to something that has meaning. So, talking about, to give the latter example that he gave here, the trees tell the thorn, you go be our king, that's just a fable. But if you remember the passage in Shoftim, in Judges chapter 9, you know that's where Yotam is rebuking those who chose his half-brother as king. And he's saying, it's like the thorn, the tree saying to the thorn, you should go be king over us. There's no value in the mashal, in the way that it's worded, it's the underlying lesson that matters. And then he says, sometimes it refers to a case where the mashal has a benefit in the superficial layer, even though its true benefit is in the hidden layer. And the one teaching the mashal intends both benefits, even though his main benefit is for the benefit hidden in the hidden layer. He says sometimes there are two lessons to be learned, one from the superficial parable and one from what's below. So as an example, he had the passage before where he talked about the fool who wanders past the house of the dangerous woman at night, right? So there is a lesson there. Don't go to a bad part of town at night. But the message he really wants to get across is the deeper message there, which is what you do with your wisdom and your learning and who you learn from. Then he says, the third paragraph in number 15, sometimes it refers to a case where the intent is only for the lesson, like the first type, but the speaker attaches the mention of the lesson to the mashal, such that the lesson is the essence of the statement. In other words, sometimes it's actually explicit in the text. It gives you the lesson, and it gives you what you're supposed to learn from it, the parable and what you're supposed to learn from it, very explicitly in the text. This is like this. And then finally, the book also includes, I'm jumping to the bottom, the book also includes simple statements in education and guidance which do not teach of any deeper lesson. We have found that sometimes that is also called in a broad sense a mashal. That could also be called a mashal. All of these qualify as mashal. A mashal is simply an educational lesson, usually with layers to it. The Vilna Gaon, in source number 16, puts it very succinctly. He says, there's the written Torah, and then there's a spoken Torah, right? Torah Shebechsav and Torah Shebealpeh. So he says, the written Torah is called mashal. For the mashal is always understood, you can understand it on the straightforward level, but it is garb for its example and a wonder, that it's covering something else beneath it, that is the lesson that you learn from it. So the words of the written Torah are understood, but wondrous things are clothed by it. You can learn the written Torah and read it and understand it, but there is deeper meaning that's going on below the surface. And then you have also, I brought you the Maharsha, Rabbi Shmuel Edel, saying the same thing in number 17. Clear? We have this? Okay. So the lessons in Mishlei tend to be presented in poetic form. You'll have sentences with one clause, sentences with two clauses, sentences with three clauses, but it's always, or generally I should say, in some kind of poetic form. In Tanakh, a mashal may be poetic and might not be. And I can give you examples that are more or less. In Mishlei, they tend to be truly poetic with a meter and a structure. Avigdor Hurwitz calls these literary mishalim, as opposed to popular mishalim. But one last note, and then I'll take any comments. Don't get stuck on the poetic form. Professor Mordechai Zer Kavod has an article on Chidot B'Sefer Mishlei, which I'm going to come back to, hopefully, in a week or two, because I really like what he did. But he's talking about a particular line in Mishlei in which the text doesn't seem to fit a poetic meter. There's a piece of it that just doesn't fit. So look what he says, my translation in number 18. He says, in the new commentary, the German and English, the verse is taught regarding one who blesses one way verbally, another in the heart, and they omit the quality. You know what? I don't want to rush it. It's too good a quote for me to rush it. I'm not going to do that. We're going to start with Zer Kavod next week, because I don't want to ruin that. It's too good. Susan.
This might be an absurd question, but when I was listening to you, and I remember way back in the chat we learned Mishlei, but it sort of sounds like the fable is Aesop, and the others took it from Mishlei. Is that some of their stories? Has anybody ever said that?
So I don't know whether you can match up his fables to Mishlei. There is a long tradition, which we're going to talk about next week, in general in the ancient world, of that sort of literature. Mishlei isn't the only one, and it isn't the first. So I don't know, but it's an interesting question to which I don't have an answer. Janine?
I'm just wondering, this sounds almost like Hirschian, but the word mashal means to rule. And maybe a mashal is a way of internalizing or owning an idea because it's presented either as an aphorism or as a,
right.
It makes it living and you can maybe assimilate it easier.
Right. Fascinating idea.
Be a good person.
Fascinating idea. I don't know. I do think, it'd be worth taking a look in general, the writing of Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch to see whether he addresses Mashal and Moshel. It's an interesting question. I don't know. So just to sum up what we've said, number one is we saw that there are certain questions we need to address. The Jewishness of the book, the target audience of the book, we saw that it's hard to break this book up into units properly. I gave you a few different approaches, whether via the superscriptions, the headings, the style of the book in terms of being in chunks or individual lines, or the topics I identified for you on the sheet. A mashal is fundamentally a lesson with some depth to it, but there are a lot of different types of mishalim which show up in the book of Mishlei. Next week, after we do this piece from Zer Kavod, I want to talk about the message of seeking wisdom and righteousness and then dive into the question of whether there is a deeper layer in Mishlei, whether it's who exactly the target audience is. Those are our big topics for next week. Thank you very, very much, everybody. It's been great to start learning with you again. Be well.